Okay, I will call to order the City Council meeting of October 5th, 2015. Roll call, Chief Ames.
Councilor Nemeroff.
Here.
Councilor Price.
Here.
Councilor Moore.
Here.
Here.
Here. Before we have reports of councilors, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence in memory of those victims at the Umpqua Community College in Roseburg. Such a terrible, terrible tragedy, and our thoughts are with them all, but let's have a moment of silence. Thank you. We'll have reports of councilors. Councilor Nimlowell.
Thank you. Well, we got to attend a League of Oregon Cities conference in Bend last week and learned a lot. League of Oregon Cities is comprised of 247 cities throughout the state. And these cities share expertise and information on a regular basis, including this conference. We took an affordable housing tour of Bend, so learned some things there. And also, I went on a tour of Redmond and saw what they have done with urban renewal. We took a work session to learn how to work better as a council and clarifying some of our roles as city councilors. I'm most excited to be working on big picture vision items for Astoria.
Thank you. Councilor Herzig.
Thank you. Like Councilor Nemlowell, I was at the League of Oregon Cities Conference, and it's everything she says. The City of Bend has an affordable housing officer, city staff, a man named Jim Long, who's of Finnish descent, who's from this area. He worked in under Jim Tierney at Community Action Team. It was like a class reunion out there. It's incredible what they're doing. The need is as great in Bend as it is here in Astoria, on steroids kind of thing, but it was very interesting to see how the city is partnering with many private firms and developers to offer affordable housing solutions at every level, from homeless veterans to seniors to working families kind of thing. It was really, really inspiring. Going along with what Mayor Lemire mentioned, Friday the college had a session on preparing for active shooters. Chief Johnston was part of that, and other people from the community, a little handout here. And it's so disheartening to think we're preparing for when this happens again, because we all know it will happen again. We have to change that somehow in America. Part of the change on the good part is Diversity Project is presenting a panel discussion called Cops and Community, and Chief Johnston came up with that title. I didn't, so you can blame him. And we're having police from all the different coastal cities in Clatsop County. It's going to be on Thursday, October 15th, 7 to 9 p.m. in the Boynton Building, and it should be a really interesting roundtable discussion on community policing, what's working in our communities, what isn't, and how we can be part of making a part of the police a part of our community. So I hope the public will really attend this one. Thank you, Mayor.
Mm-hmm. Councilor Price?
Well, my colleagues have reported on most everything that I would, so no report. Thank you.
Councilor War.
I, too, attended the Bend conference, found fascinating, learned a whole bunch of very good things. But in my report tonight, I would like to address a couple of things that I'm really confused about. And both of them have to do with Councilor Herzig's report of councilors at our last meeting. The first one, Mr. Herzig reported that many of the residents in the Goonies neighborhood are upset because they believe they're pleased for intervention went unheard until the owner of the Goonies house finally spoke up. He was talking about the unintended consequences of the overload of people, and we understand. I live, for those who don't know, about 100 yards from the Goonie house. So all of the traffic that goes to the Goonie House comes right past my front door. So I'm acutely aware of what the situation is up there. At any rate, the only reason that I'm confused by it is last fall, city staff, the Chamber of Commerce, and myself started meeting with the neighbors up there. They had formed a committee, and we talked with them, found out you know what their complaints were, tried to address all of the issues, tried to do things with traffic control. And even though the number of people visiting the Goonie House almost exploded, when we had the 20th anniversary celebration up there 10 years ago, we had around 6,500 people. On the 25th anniversary, we had an estimate of around 9,000. The 30th anniversary, and you know, the Goonies, now a 30-year-old kids movie that most of the people who were kids when it was built are now, or when it was done, are now middle-aged. You would think that the Goonie mania would start to die off, but instead of that, this last year, estimates are that we had 12 to 15,000 people at the event, and we have been getting around 12 to 1,500 people a day visiting the Goonie House. That's been for the last 7 or 8 months. So it became a huge problem. But the city, the Chamber of Commerce, and neighbors started a year ago trying to address the issues, doing everything that was legal. One of the difficulties is 38th Street, 37th Street, 36th Street, Duane Street are all public thoroughfares, and you can't stop people from traveling on a, you know, there's no way to make that parking for residents only because of our public streets. So we were limited in a lot of the things we could do. The Chamber had stopped a lot of their advertising. They took the Goonie House off their map. They started discouraging people who came into the Chamber looking for directions to the Goonie House. They tried to dissuade them from going up there. And so there was lots and lots of time and effort put in by the city, the Chamber. We changed things, we put up lots of signs, we changed the way the signs were during the celebration. We had volunteers there directing people, answering questions, and during most of it there was a police presence there. So I think that the city, rather than ignoring the neighbors, did everything that they could legally do to handle what was there. And in Mr. Herzig's report, he said that many of the people in the neighborhood were very upset with the way things have been handled. I'm very perplexed by that. The neighbors that talk to me are giving me compliments, telling me that things are much better. And so I would ask Mr. Herzig to allow me to know who these people who aren't talking to me but are talking to him are, so I can go to them, find out what their problems are, and see if we can address it. It's very confusing. I thought we'd done a marvelous job, and apparently we have it. So, Drew, I'd like your help. The next item was about a bypass. And he said that many people in the community, because of the traffic that we've been suffering, wants a bypass, and that the city should be proactive and get started. And, you know, we have said that ODOT doesn't have funding for a bypass, and he said, well, ODOT's still in business. We need to get proactive and get in line, or get to the front of the line. The thing that he probably isn't aware is that back in the 90s, I became a member of a committee who had been actively pursuing a bypass around Astoria since 1957. Right after, oh, and excuse me, we got funded for that bypass, or we got recommended for funding for the bypass, and then it was later withdrawn, but the ODOT had established the route. They had done the preliminary engineering. They had not done an environmental impact statement. But we thought at that time that the bypass was going to happen. Because of budget constraints, ODOT pulled the funding on it. In about 2005, I was a member of an ODOT committee, which was a regional traffic visioning plan that went on for 2 years, and we looked at all of the traffic issues in the area. There were several of us that were very, very strong advocates for a bypass at that time. Even though we advocated as strongly as we knew how to advocate, the bypass didn't happen. After that, I was on a transportation system plan update for the Jeffers Garden area again, and every time we had a meeting, I talked about bypass. Just over the last couple of years, I was a member of the Astoria Transportation System Plan update. We met for a couple of years and studied what we could do within our budget constraints. But at every meeting, I mentioned bypass. Up until 2 years ago, for all of the time since I've been on the city council, advocating for a bypass has been a city council goal. Now it's a part of a hodgepodge of other things, and it's lost its effect. But I'm also, and for the last 8 years, have been a member of the Northwest Area Commission on Transportation, which is an ODOT commission that studies, and the Northwest Area Commission on Transportation is for the Tri-County area, Clatsop County, Columbia County, Tillamook County, and the western part of Washington County. We meet every other month and look at transportation issues, projects, some we recommend for funding. Most of what we recommend for funding don't get funded because ODOT is having a very, very difficult time for funding. As a case in point, the Connect Oregon 1, which happened 6 or 7 years ago, was a funding agency. The state gave the Connect Oregon program $100 million for programs around the state, and the ACTS analyzed these programs, recommended the ones that they thought could be funded. Over the last 3 or 4 years, that has funding for that program has slowed down dramatically. I think that we have, with this next cycle, instead of $100 million to spend, we have $9 million. Here again, that's another indicator that ODOT does not have the money to build a bypass. They're telling us that the quality of the roads in Oregon over the next 15 years are going to suffer badly, and their estimates, and I think it's around 40% of the roads are going to be in good condition, meaning 60% of the roads are going to be what they consider in poor condition. Here again, that's a funding issue. So we haven't just been hanging back on bypasses. There's been lots and lots of time spent by me, but also by staff over the years, and the lack of funding for a bypass, no matter how bad we hate to think that there is not somehow funding for a bypass, is the lack of money is really real. And Drew, if you have a good idea and would like to bring it forward, I certainly would like to hear about it, because I've tried everything I can think of over the last 20 years to make a bypass happen, and it just hasn't, and it I don't think will in my lifetime. And that ends my report.
Okay, thank you. I too went to the League of Oregon Cities Conference in Bend and learned a lot. I'm going to spend my time, though, telling you about some committees that have recently been formed and who has been appointed to those committees. We now have a Heritage Square Project Advisory Committee, and the people that are on that, Cindy Mudge from the Sunday Market, Dulcie Taylor from the Downtown Association, Paul Caruana from Historic Landmarks, Sean Fitzpatrick from the Planning Commission, Norma Hernandez from the Parks Board, Kate Summers from the Library, Jen Butenchen from Columbia Bank, Dan Stein, who is an at-large member. So this is a really good group of people, and I'm excited. I think all of the council is excited to see what they come up with as a vision for Heritage Square. The Maritime Memorial Park Committee has recently lost two members, and I'm appointing Kim Supple and Caroline Webben to that Maritime Memorial Park Committee. And then the last committee is the Parks and Recreation Master Plan. This is something we have been working on for a long time and are excited about. We really need to take a look at all of our parks and how we can best utilize the parks we have. The people that are on that committee, Ed Overbay, who was a former Parks Advisory Board member, Peter O'Farrell, who is on the Parks Advisory Board, Zeddy Nemluel from the City Council, Michelle Bissick, who was with the Friends of the Dog Park, and is also on the Astoria Parks Recreation and Community Foundation, Jorge Gutierrez from the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council, Craig Hoppus, the School District, Patrick Wingard, the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development, Dulcie Taylor, the Downtown Historic District Association, Scott Tucker, Lewis and Clark National Historic Park, Kasia Nye, the Moms Club and Astoria Parks Recreation and Community Foundation, Brooke Stanley, the North Coast Watershed Association, and Jan Niebaki, a citizen. So again, I'm thank you to all these people who said yes when we called them, because all of these committees are going to take a lot of time, and we really appreciate their efforts. I also met with Jorge Gutierrez this week, and they, excuse me, letter. Okay, thank you. The Lower Columbia Hispanic Council was selected in December of 2014 as one of 25 cities or 25 groups to receive a $30,000 grant as part of a program called Healthy Beginnings and Healthy Communities. So they've been working all year to kind of bridge the divide between Latinos and the general community in several ways. They've expanded the coordinator position to allow for greater services. There just wasn't enough time in the day for Jorge to react to all the services he was asked to perform. They've established an advisory group of 18 members. They've reached out to Columbia Memorial Hospital and the Astoria School District to bring attention to disparities in health and education services. And they're planning a community-wide Dia de los Muertos event the Day of the Dead. So that's going to be coming up, I believe, November 1st at the Barbie Center, Columbia River Maritime Museum Barbie Center. And now they are going for one of only 10 communities in the whole state of Oregon for five-year community-based partnerships. And they will get a lot of support from this Northwest Health Foundation if they receive that grant. So I did write a letter in support and endorsement of their efforts. So I wanted to let you know that. Okay, next we have some proclamations. Fire Prevention Week. Whereas the City of Astoria is committed to ensuring the safety and security of all those living in and visiting our city, and whereas fire is a serious public safety concern in Astoria and homes are the places where people are at the greatest risk from fire, and whereas home fires killed more than 118 Oregonians from 2010 through 2014, and whereas working smoke alarms are a vital component to protecting families from fire and reduce the risk of dying in a home fire by half, and whereas residents should install smoke alarms in every bedroom, outside each sleeping area, and on every level of the home, and whereas residents are responsive to public education measures and are able to take personal steps to increase their safety from fire, especially in their homes, and whereas the 2015 National Fire Prevention Week theme, "Hear the Beep Where You Sleep," "Every Bedroom Needs a Working Smoke Alarm," serves to remind us that all bedrooms need a working smoke alarm to give us the time to get out safely. Now, therefore, I, Arlene Lemire, Mayor of Astoria, do hereby proclaim the week of October 4th through October 10th as Fire Prevention Week, and encourage all Astorians to join in this observance. So, Chief Ames, if you'll come forward and introduce your firefighters.
They're actually here to listen to the herbicide. I have Lieutenant Bob Johnson. Please stand, Bob. I have driver engineer Rob Wiseman and driver engineer Aaron Dielmeyer. Thank you guys very much.
Okay, the next proclamation is for the Great Oregon Shakeout Day. Whereas the City of Astoria has no greater responsibility than ensuring the safety of its citizens and all who visit our city, and whereas earthquake safety is a serious concern with much of our state at risk to seismic shaking and tsunami hazards, and whereas the best way to survive natural disasters and other emergencies is to develop a preparedness plan for your school, business, home, and family, and whereas being self-sufficient for 2 weeks after a natural disaster, as well as knowledge about what to do when disasters occur, is vital, and whereas all citizens, businesses, and governmental agencies are encouraged to participate in earthquake and emergency drills where they practice drop, cover, and hold on, at 10:15 a.m. on Thursday, October 15th, during the Great Oregon Shakeout Day. Now, therefore, I, Arlene Lemire, Mayor of Astoria, do hereby proclaim October 15th, 2015, to be the Great Oregon Shakeout Day in the City of Astoria, and encourage all Astoria residents to participate in this event. Along with that, Chief Johnston, would you like to just mention a little bit about this program that we're planning for later in the year?
I don't know that I'm the best person to talk about it, because somehow I proposed it and other department heads ended up with the work from it. What we are planning on October 15th at 10:15 a.m. is to conduct for the city of Astoria a test of our preparedness. And we will be at that time evacuating our buildings, actually first stop, cover, and hold, as if there was an earthquake, and then practicing our evacuation, our accountability, and those portions of our emergency plan. And we're encouraging, you'll see on the police department's Facebook page over the next week, we're gonna be encouraging people to look at earthquake safety, emergency preparedness issues, and just kind of take stock, make sure you have a plan, make sure you know what your business's plan is, and maybe join us in exercising it on October 15th at 10:15 a.m.
Okay, thank you. And we will have another agenda item that deals with some emergency preparedness briefing that we're going to be talking about a program for the community later in the spring. So thank you, Chief Johnson. Changes to the agenda.
So there were three items which were added to the agenda, and we have prepared a revised agenda which was available to all the community members if you picked them up. One is an item 7E, authorization to award 39th Street Sanitary Sewer Repair Project. The next one is regarding FERC hearings, regarding the environmental impact statement for the Oregon LNG project. And then lastly, the Aquatic Center lifeguard pay.
Okay, thank you. No changes from the citizens?
No, there were no requests for removal of items from the consent calendar.
Okay, thank you.
In answer to that.
Okay, the consent calendar is next then. Are there any items to remove?
Item D, please.
Item A, I have a correction to the minutes.
Okay. Could we have a motion to approve items 6B, C, E, F, and G?
I so move.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Isn't it a roll call?
Yes.
Chief Johnson, roll call.
Councilor Demelow?
Aye.
Councilor Ward?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Councilor Herzig?
Aye.
Mayor
Lemire? Aye. Okay, City Council minutes, 6A.
Yes, thank you, Madam Mayor. I have two small corrections, but kind of important. Page 15 of 18, the second graph, my comments, the second sentence should read, 8 years ago, about 70% of the county and 65% of Astorians did not agree and voted no to the pipeline. And then page 17 of 18 of the minutes, the 11th graph, again the second sentence, she said the task force might recommend the warming center as a useful tool as it considers possibilities. And then she did not believe the city would deviate much from this budget.
So we would need a motion, second, and vote for consideration of the minutes.
Okay, before we handle the next one?
Right, so okay. We'd handle this one.
Roll call or?
This one could be just handled by okay. a regular vote.
Okay, could we have a motion to approve item 6A?
I would move that we approve the minutes with the corrections as Councilor Price stated.
I'll second.
All those second. In favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, item D, Councilor Nimlowell.
That has to do with the liquor license application, and I would like to declare a potential conflict of interest due to ownership in a business that sells beer, Cervecia Gratis, or Fort George, but I do not believe that it is a direct conflict, so I will vote.
Could we have a motion to approve item 6D?
I so move.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Okay, the first item on the regular agenda item is the consideration of adoption of an herbicide policy and practices. Yes?
So the plant and lawn management task force was appointed by the mayor earlier this year to address issues that were raised about the use of herbicides and fertilizers in parks. This task force has been working over the past few months and obtained feedback from a variety of stakeholders who are interested in this issue. The task force later developed some recommendations for a herbicide use policy that was presented to the Parks Board and ultimately approved at their September 23rd meeting. So I would note on the second page of the staff report is the policy and practices which were drafted by the task force and recommended for approval by the Parks Board. Tonight, it's recommended that the City Council consider the policy and practices and that the City Council adopt the document as included in your memo.
Okay, great. Thank you, by the way, for all the work you've put into this, Angela. Our Parks and Rec Department person seems to be going in a lot of different directions, and this was an important task force, so thank you for all your efforts and the efforts of the whole team.
Thank you. The large majority of the credit goes to Jonah Dartmouth-Lean, our maintenance supervisor. He was the main maintenance.
Good. Okay. Any questions or comments about this from the council?
Again, I want to thank Jonah Dartmouth-Lean. It was like herding cats for him to get this group together, but he did it very effectively and kept it moving forward. And it was a real fascinating discussion. Jessica Schleif is passionate about our parks and our landscaping. She was a real addition. And I want to thank the citizens, including Jessica and Christopher Farrar, who brought this to our attention and asked us to consider it. So it's been a very productive conversation, and I think we've got a policy that we can really be happy with. And again, thank you, Angela, for completing this.
So I move we adopt the herbicide policy and practices.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Great. And again, thanks to the whole Parks Department. The next item is authorization to enter into a contract with Pierce Manufacturing for the purchase of a new fire ladder truck.
At your September 14th meeting, the council approved purchasing a new replacement ladder truck by proceeding with steps which were outlined in your September 28th memo, and these were presented at the September 14th meeting. Since that time, a price sheet and purchase agreement was secured by Chief Ames, and I would note that based upon the scenario to pay cash for this item, we would be receiving discounts in the amount of $55,321. The discounts are contingent again upon making the 100% cash payment. The total price for this ladder truck would be $943,440. I would note that there is a performance bond which is included in this purchase price since the city would be paying cash. There is an associated item on this council agenda, which is a budget hearing for an amendment to this current fiscal year's budget, and we'll go into more of that detail on the next item should council approve this item with regards to purchase. So it's recommended that the city enter into a purchase agreement with Pierce Manufacturing through our membership with the Houston-Galveston Area Council, which is a purchasing cooperative agency, for the purchase of the new ladder truck as outlined in the memo.
Okay.
And Chief Ames will be able to answer any questions that you may have.
Comments or questions from the council?
I want to mention part of our consent calendar was an authorization for emergency repairs for our current fire ladder truck, which came to a little over $15,000. So not to make Chief Ames more upset, but when he says the trucks are literally falling apart, he's not exaggerating. So we really need to move forward with this, and I'm glad we found a way to do it. Sorry, Ted, to blow your cover there. But.
I really appreciate Chief Ames and the city manager for finding a way for us to pay cash for a new ladder truck and save the city so much money, $55,000. I'm really glad that we were able to do that. Thank you.
Yes, I would like to echo Councilor Nimmowill's comments. It was part of the budget hearings that we tried to look for ways to pay cash for things or to make the payments over a much shorter period of time and save money, and this is a really great example of being able to do that. So thanks to all who made it happen: finance, city manager, Chief Ames.
Okay, could we have a motion?
I move we enter into the purchase agreement with Pierce Manufacturing as recommended by city manager.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, the next item is a public hearing and resolution regarding supplemental budget for fiscal year 2015-16 for purchase of a new fire ladder truck.
So Oregon Revised Statutes provides a procedure for a municipality to pass a supplemental budget to adjust for changes which occur during a fiscal year. This supplemental budget would increase resources and the related requirements by $465,000. And again, this increase is a transfer from the general fund to the capital improvement fund. This increase deals with two items. The first is the purchase of the ladder truck, which was the prior agenda item. And the second item relates to changes in features for the pumper truck, which was purchased last fiscal year. Construction of the pumper truck is complete and it is in transit to Astoria. We understand it may arrive here this week. Am I correct, Chief Ames? The total invoice for changes which were required during construction is $10,848, which is over the city manager's spending authority. So what we are asking is that council approve $11,000 of the general fund to cover the payment required to complete the pumper truck. I would note there is a corresponding transfer to the general fund. As I noted a little bit earlier, that this is money which is going from the general fund to the capital improvement fund. Tonight, it's recommended that council conduct a public hearing on this matter. This is the first item that would need to occur. And then if council approves these transactions, it's recommended that council consider adopting the resolution for the supplemental budgets.
Okay. I will open the public hearing. Anyone want to speak on this issue? Okay, public hearing is closed. Could we have a motion?
I move that we adopt the resolution adopting a supplemental budget for the City of Astoria, resolution number 15-.
Second.
Okay,
And we'll need roll call.
Roll call. Okay, Chief Johnston.
Councilor Nimmowill.
Aye.
Councilor Orr.
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Councilor Herzig?
Aye.
Mayor
Lemire? Aye. Okay, and 7D is an emergency preparedness briefing concept. So
I'll just do a brief introduction and then turn it over to the chiefs if they want to add anything additional. So Chiefs Johnson and Ames have been working to develop a concept for implementation of the City Council goal for this fiscal year, which states, hold an emergency preparedness presentation oriented to the citizens of Astoria. And again, this concept is to focus on emergency preparedness for annual emergency events such as winter storms, wildfire danger, as well as earthquakes. So this event would be targeted for spring of 2016, and additional information on this concept was outlined in your September 28th memo. Tonight, staff is recommending that there be council discussion on implementation of this goal and discussion. If there are any comments or thoughts with regards to this concept, we'd like to be able to hear this tonight so the chiefs can get moving forward on implementation. And Chiefs Ames and Johnston, if you have anything else to add.
I just say this is kind of your show. We're trying to satisfy your goal, and we want to make sure we're hitting the mark. We kind of outlined briefly some concepts there in the memo, but
really want to know if that's headed the right direction for council consensus, or if we've missed the mark and we'd like to do so early instead of late. Know that we're off course.
Well, two things I was excited about. It's going to be at the Liberty Theater, which means it gives us plenty of room for the community to come. And the second thing is the idea of having displays and so forth outside in the lobby. I think that's great because we have a good CERT team. We have a lot of things in the works for preparation for an emergency. So that's good to be able to see the visuals appreciate that.
Madam Mayor, I think overall it looks like a good plan. I have to say I am a little bit concerned about the youth in our area being prepared and aware of, I think, what all of us grown-ups are aware of, and the very real threat of a Cascadia subduction event. I talked to my kids a while ago who were in first and second grade and said, do you guys, have you learned anything in school about an earthquake or tsunami? And they hadn't. And they're at Astor School, and that's a big concern. And I've been talking to them, and it's different talking to kids than adults because talking about these threats is really scary. And you have to be able to teach them what to do in an earthquake and how to protect yourself from a tsunami without giving them nightmares at night. And so I imagine this event would be more oriented toward adults with the types of speakers that we'd be having. And so I don't know if this would be an appropriate time to discuss how the city could help address educating our youth about the very real threat of an earthquake and tsunami.
I can help answer that a little bit. The last couple of years that I've been over here, we, as a department, go up to Astor School each year, and we do classroom presentations to each of the classrooms at Astor School. And primarily, it's directed towards fire safety and fire prevention in the home, and it's age and grade appropriate information. I do know that the schools, both here in Astoria and across the bay, do some education as far as earthquake and tsunami, but you're correct in trying to get the message across to really small people without causing nightmares. So one of the things that we've been talking about this year, when we go up to Astor, it'll be late in the this month, is trying to inject a little bit more information that's age and class appropriate. Of course, running it past the teachers. That's just one portion of our younger population, but it's a baby step.
The other thing that I know the schools are doing along this lines is their standard response protocol. They talk about it in response to school shootings. They talk about it in response to fires and those kind of things. But it really is an all-weather or an all-hazards kind of a plan with the lock in, lock out, evacuate, and shelter in place. They have those as part of their drills. They have those in all the classrooms. And I bet if you talk to your children about SRP, they'll know what SRP is, and they can probably tell you a lot about the school's preparedness right there. So that and the reunification plan that the school has is probably the thing that they're doing the most to prepare them when they're at the school. But then there's the rest of it that is the, when they're at home or they're not at school, that we need to work on probably.
I think one thing we could do for this meeting is reach out to the educators, make sure we do that if at all possible, and also make sure that we reach out to the broader community so that we include county emergency management, if somebody from Camp Rylea can come. Because as we learned, even from less catastrophic event than a Cascadia subduction, earthquake, and tsunami, even from 2007, that it, we all will be working together. The county and all of the municipalities have to work together. So this looks pretty good. I think we are going to probably learn a lot from this town hall about what our community would like to hear from us perhaps again, and I hope we'll be open to that. But thank you very much for this good start.
My only question is, and I certainly don't have an answer, is that we live in such a wonderful part of the world that our chances for real hazards from many different places are real. You know, wind storms and fire and subduction zone quakes and many other things. Do we need to break this into smaller bites and do two or three, or do you think we can get a good message out with just one presentation?
I think if we plan this correctly and do things kind of the way that Brad and I tried to outline it, the idea is to try and get a few subject matter experts to come in and talk about one topic, and then another person come in and talk about another one, and take little bites of the elephant, and try and give at least an initial dose of information to folks who can attend on a number of different sessions, if that helps.
Thanks, Chief.
Okay, and
I'm happy to see staff moving forward with this. Thank you, Chief Ames and Chief Johnston. I'm concerned, though, about the Liberty Theater. The presentations I've been, they're not user-friendly. It's a big, big space. The screen up on the stage is too far away for me to read, and it doesn't further a conversation. I'd really like to see something a little bit smaller, possibly the Maritime Museum or the Lovell Showroom or the Boynton Building, or I'm not sure if the Astoria Armory would be appropriate, but someplace where we're all on a level and there isn't that great separation that I've encountered whenever we do a presentation with information slides at the Liberty. I just can't follow it. It's just too far away. So I know we're very proud of the Liberty, but I'd like the organizers to think about it, possibly look at some different facilities to maybe make it more of a place where people can interact. And I know that most of those venues I've suggested would have room for displays as well. So just a suggestion. Thanks.
Okay. This item does not require any action. We just wanted to let the public know that we are working on this, and much more information will come. We've had three additional items. The first is the authorization to award 39th Street sanitary sewer repair.
So the public works staff had planned to complete a repaving project on 39th Street between Franklin and Grand Avenues to address some concerns which were raised and also a severely deteriorating road condition. During the pre-paving inspection of the utilities within that right-of-way, staff identified two damaged portions of sanitary sewer pipe, and this work would need to be completed prior to the paving work. Staff received two quotes on the project, with the lowest being for Big River Construction in the amount of $21,970. Funding for the project would come from the Public Works Improvement Fund. I would note that that needing to do this utility work would require the pavement restoration project to be postponed until next year. Tonight, it's recommended that Council authorize the award of a construction contract to Big River Construction Incorporated.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Okay, Jan Ruda is going to come forward and talk to us about the FERC hearings for Oregon LNG and the draft environmental impact statement.
Thanks for seeing me tonight.
Yeah. And if you'll give your name and address.
My name is Jennifer Ruda. I live at 7 Skyline Place, Astoria, Oregon.
Or just pull it if you want.
Oh, sorry.
That. Pull it down there.
Thank you. So 7 Astoria Place, 7 Skyline Place, Astoria, Oregon. So I just wanted to let you know, I'm new in town, and when I saw Oregon LNG come up, I thought I'd try to get a copy of the draft environmental impact statement. For work, I'm an energy planner, and so I regularly manage or write these types of documents. So for me, it's just interesting to see what the document looked like. I have no opinion for or against Oregon LNG. I was just interested in the process. So early in September, I tried to get a copy of the document. I emailed Oregon LNG in their comment system. I got an email back. They got my request, but I didn't receive the document after 2 weeks. And that's fine. I figured, okay, I'll hop on the FERC comment website and put in the same request. Please send me a copy of the document. I tried twice, and the system was down. So I was kind of frustrated by that. So I saw that the public meetings were happening on the 21st of September. So I just went over to the county, the fairgrounds, to go pick up a copy. It's very typical and for these types of meetings that are on the draft document to go pick up a copy at the location where they're having the meeting. I went there, and there were no copies available. There weren't even copies on display, which, as someone who writes these documents, I found unusual, because if someone wanted to refer to the document, they wouldn't have a copy available. So I asked for copies of fact sheets, just basic information on the project, and they had no information on site. I brought some examples. This is a type of fact sheets that I have prepared for a major transmission line project. Just, you know, what is the power line, how do you use it, a couple copies in Spanish for Spanish speakers, basic information. So none of this was available at the meeting. So I asked for a CD, and they didn't have any. So I put in a written comment asking FERC to please mail me a hard copy of the document. And that was on the 21st. The FERC representative and their consultant said, sure, we can do that. I said, great. So I went home, and I also called the consultant, because I happen to know them in Portland, HDR, and asked for a copy. They said, we'll send you one. So on the 30th of September, I still hadn't received any documentation from FERC. So I called HDR again and said, hey, where's my copy? And they said, we have very few copies available. And I said, it's very normal to request a hard copy. If how can you comment on the detail without a copy of this material? It's very technical. These are printed as a matter of course. Here's a copy from 2010 for a major solar project in Nevada. I mean, these are available to the public to review. And it's not reasonable to have to review it online. It's a 1,000-page PDF. You want to refer back and forth. It's very difficult for a review. So, I mean, I have like 5 of these at home. It's not hard to get these normally. I was not given a copy. I asked them to immediately print and FedEx me a copy, because the comment period is closing on Tuesday. They said, yep, we'll try to do that. The project manager from FERC is out on Friday, and I don't have a copy of the tracking number. So this morning, I got a package, and I now have a copy of the draft EIS for Oregon LNG, but only volume 1. So I want you to know that volume 1, these are very normal. I mean, these documents are, you know, cookie cutter. So anybody who's in this line of work and has been for 15 years can immediately jump in and find certain things. So I looked and checked the table of contents for volume 1, and sure enough, volume 2 has things that would be very interesting to review, like the safety advisory report, all the detailed maps and drawings, the mitigation plans, the technical details for soils, wetlands, water bodies, all the information on the species. So it's very difficult to review volume 1 without being able to refer to volume 2. And so I think that it's been very difficult for a member of the public who's educated on the process to just get the information. And I wanted to let you know, and I think that FERC really should extend their comment period, and I think they really should provide hard copies of the documents at the local libraries and some copies for the city to review. And I'm really surprised they didn't, as a matter of course, prepare some basic fact sheets and have a couple of them available. So I just wanted to let you know that was my experience, and I'd be more than happy to answer questions on the typical NEPA review process if you have any.
Thank you, Jan. You have really stuck to this issue a lot more than I think most of us would have. You've been very persistent, I believe you've also written a letter. We've passed that through our attorney. And so we would like to be able to send that letter to FERC requesting a delay, a 30-day
extension for the review.
Extension, right.
Thanks.
Madam Mayor, it's a great letter, and thank you very much for providing a draft. I would only suggest that we might want to extend that to a 60-day extension request, because that would comport with what Senators Wyden and Merkley and Congresswoman Bonamici have requested of FERC, is a 60-day extension.
Mm. That's fine. The required comment period is 45 days. They've already had 60, just letting you know.
Right.
That's perfectly normal to ask for a 30 or 60-day extension. I would assume they would grant this.
Okay. And Jennifer, thank you very much for sharing your expertise on this issue. It's something that probably slipped by a lot of other people, the lack of access to hard copies, just because they don't have as much experience as you do with this. So thank you on that. Given that October 6th is the last day for the comment period, how would you suggest that we submit this letter in a timely fashion?
Well, the FERC offices are on the East Coast, so I would suggest you email it in the morning. And I would recommend just going right to the FERC secretary to make sure that they're aware of the city's interest in having an extension.
Thank you.
Okay. So is it the council's consensus that we change it to 60 days then?
I would move that we submit the letter to FERC with a change to extend the comment period by 60 days, as Councillor Price suggested.
I'll second that.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And thank you, Jennifer, very much. You've done yeoman work.
And lots of upper body strength carrying that stuff around.
Okay, and our last item on the agenda is the Aquatic Center lifeguard pay. And Ms. Cosby is going to give us an update.
Sure. Real quick, just to introduce this item. Recently, the Aquatic Center has completed some renovations. This was a project that included replastering the swimming pool, new lights in the energy efficient LED lights throughout the entire Aquatic Center, and also new shower facilities within both the men's and women's restrooms. That project is now complete, and when the Aquatic Center needed to reopen, the city was not able to reopen at full hours due to the fact that we have lost a number of our lifeguards due to wages. It's an issue that's become an issue where many of our employees have, or several of our lifeguard employees have taken employment elsewhere, and so this issue was brought to the City Council's attention, and there were councilors who asked that this be discussed at tonight's meeting. So, park staff, in conjunction with the finance department staff, and I put together a proposal, and Ms. Cosby is going to give a presentation on this matter.
So as Brett mentioned, currently we close the Aquatic Center between 1 and 3:30 p.m. due to the lifeguard shortage. And this problem, it's not completely brand new. It's been compounding over the past 2 years, and especially over the last 6 months. And it's obviously largely come to a head. So as we get into it, we're going to be talking about a lot of numbers, so I thought I'd spend a few seconds reviewing where the Aquatic Center spends its money. So you can see from 2013 to then the budget for 2016, our revenue and expenses, and it basically is staying borderline. You'll notice there's no revenues for 2013. That's the year the Parks Fund moved into being an enterprise fund, and the numbers for the Aquatic Center are also compiled with all of the different parks and recreation revenue. So it's a bit difficult to pull out those numbers. However, I'd assume it's very similar to those other blue lines. So a very important graph to look at. This is out of our expenses, where we spend our money over the past 4 years. And you can see our personnel is obviously our highest expense. And that over the last few years, as minimum wage continues to go up and up, it's costing us more and more for our personnel. And then utilities being the next largest expense after that. Another look at our expenses. This is the budget amount for 2016. Again, personnel. We have one full-time benefited employee at the Aquatic Center, Pam Pierce, and then after that, we have about 37 lifeguards that are all part-time, non-benefited positions. Part of the challenge we are seeing is that the unemployment rates in our county keep dropping and dropping as the economy is improving, and that's part of our challenge in getting lifeguards to work for low rates. This graph doesn't represent that Clatsop County has the lowest unemployment rate out of the entire state, but it does show how low we in fact are. So our current pay rates, lifeguards at the Aquatic Center make $9.25. That is the state's minimum wage. We cannot pay them lower. To be a lifeguard, it is a certified position. You have to take a 40-hour course, pass a test. It is pretty time intensive. Then we also have water safety instructors. Those are the folks teaching swim lessons. They make 25 cents more an hour while they're teaching that course. So if you're a lifeguard and a swim instructor, you'd make that additional 25 cents only during your instruction time. And then we have leads. Those are the folks that have keys to the facility. They supervise others during the shifts and they make sure everything is operational. As we go into the next slide, we're gonna be reviewing lifeguard wages. I didn't review lifeguard wages for the water safety. I didn't demonstrate in the graphs the wages for water safety instructors or the leads. I did do some comparables, but we're looking at so many ranges, I thought it would get confusing. Plus the very bulk of our personnel are lifeguards. So these are our current pay rate comparisons. You'll see Astoria is at the bottom with 925, and this is the high end. All of our lifeguards do make 925 an hour. Some of the other organizations, they may range, say Eugene, ranges between $13 and $15.45. So this is the high end of the scale. And then I also highlighted Sunset Empire Parks and Recreation District because they are our largest competitor in the region. And they're also in the same unemployment pool in the same demographics as us. Then we took a look at what we think we needed to actually pay our lifeguards to be able to make up this shortage and be able to keep people around as well as be comparable with Sunset Empire. My proposal was to pay lifeguards $11.25 to $13 an hour. Clearly, you start with us, you start at the $11.25, and then after a 6-month probationary period, you can have one step increase of 25 cents. Another year after that, 25 cent increments, just like many of our other staff. Water safety instructors, a dollar up from that, making $12.25 to $14, and lead water safety instructors and lifeguards, a dollar up from there. What I did find, even though I didn't demonstrate in the graphs with these comparables, is these are on the low end for water safety instructors and leads. Many of the other organizations pay between $15 to $17 an hour for those. I just didn't feel that we actually needed to keep those staff on hand. I thought we needed to pay the lifeguards. That's our biggest challenge. So I thought it would be a priority area there. So then looking at the same graph, but with our proposed rates, you would see we would be very comparable with Sunset Empire as well as Hood River in that area with our maximum payout of $13 an hour for lifeguards. So then what it really comes down to is the estimated cost to transition from our current rates to the proposed rates is approximately $57,000 a year after those increases, and that also does increases for FICA, and then we actually do pay into some PERS for those employees as well.
So in going on from here, the changes to the wages is something that could be completed administratively. This is something that would not require City Council consideration. However, I would not want to make any changes to any wages without looking at two things. The first thing is the current fiscal year's budget. And as you're aware, this year's Parks Department budget is based upon a scenario where we're trying to get away from the year-end transfers. We acknowledge that because this is the first year that we're going away from the model that had the year-end transfers every year, that there may need to be some adjustments. But if there were changes to the wages, this would most likely require a year-end transfer come June of 2016. Our current fund balance would be able to accommodate that transfer, but then we need to look at the second thing, which is sustainability and longevity and being able to afford these rates. And so, as Angela had pointed out, when you look at the revenues have been fairly stable since 2008 when, and that was the last time we had changes to the Parks Department fee schedule, which includes how much people pay for swim passes and swim lessons and so on and so forth. If these changes were to be put in place, we would look at the need to be able to adjust and increase the Parks Department fee schedule to be able to afford these wage rates in the future. And so what we're asking for is some discussion from council as to whether or not they would be comfortable with acknowledging there would need to be an ending fund balance transfer at the end of this fiscal year to be able to accommodate this, and some level of support of staff looking at an amendment to the Parks Department fee schedule to address these additional expenses. I would note that, you know, if the lifeguard rates stayed as is, what we're going to be needing to look at is keeping, assuming we're not going to continue not to be able to locate employees as potentially have hours that the Aquatic Center would be closed. I would say that since we've opened the Aquatic Center back up, we've had actually another lifeguard leave us. And so there may need to be flexibility in actually having additional times that the Aquatic Center need to be closed. The flip side is that whenever we have the Aquatic Center closed, we're not providing the service to the community, but also we're not bringing in the revenue, which helps offset the expenses to be able to pay for these services. So that's the flip side. So we're just wanting to be able to have the dialogue and discussion tonight. If council is supportive of taking the action of an ending fund balance transfer and also look at a rate increase for park services, staff would look at adjusting the wage rates for the lifeguards.
Council discussion?
Well, we know this money will stay in the community. I really think this is the right thing to do for a number of reasons, to keep the Aquatic Center open on a regular basis, and knowing that our young people who are trying to get started in life get a fair wage for this. I don't know how Sunset Empire makes all the money they're making kind of thing, so maybe we can do some research on that. But I would certainly support this for a number of reasons. We need to pay people an adequate wage. That's part of our discussion on how to live in Astoria. And we know this money will go right back into the community, so I'm all in favor of this. And I think at this point, expecting Parks and Rec to pay for itself, it's not going to happen, despite our best efforts and the best management possible. So I think we need to just accept that and keep moving forward.
I agree.
I agree too, and I'm supportive of taking a look at incremental fee increases on an annual basis, so it's not too much of a shock to users, but it certainly makes sense as annually labor costs rise that be offset by fee increases as well. I also look forward to the park's master plan. I don't think that it's going to take a comprehensive approach at making the Parks Department more efficient financially, but hopefully it will help us to identify what the community's priorities are with Parks and Rec. So I'm in support of this.
Yes, I support it as well, although I would say that this is a really brilliant example of how something that I know that the finance department is working toward, which is providing us either with quarterly budget summaries so we know where are we right now with the parks budget, and also that when items like this come before us, to come with the budget summary so that we could see really right now tonight, or as close to tonight as possible, you know, where are we? So I have perfect confidence in city managers and staff's saying where we are with the budget and what's requested, and I'm good with it. But I do think this is really a great example of how that would be really super useful. But yes, to all, sustainability and to raising the pay.
Mayor? I believe also the advantage of having the Parks Master Plan is that we will be able to go after grants and funding that we are not currently eligible for without that plan. So there is hope for the future as far as that goes. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
All right, great, thanks.
I also wanted to note, you know, I think this is reflective of not only the public sector, but the private sector as well. It's just really challenging to find competent workers in Astoria right now. And I hope that the wage increase works.
So tonight, what I would ask is, I'd like to be able to have some council action on this, even though the increasing of the wages is something that staff could do administratively. There are some policy implications with regards to the ending fund balance and also the fee proposal. And so I'd be looking for a motion that staff implement the wage increases for lifeguards, understanding that a year-end transfer may be required and that a fee increase proposal be prepared by park staff.
So moved.
I like that. Okay.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who has any new business to bring before us tonight? Okay, then we will be recessing.
Madam Mayor?
Yes.
I'm very sorry, but I do have one thing that I hope will be quick. I've sort of talked about this before, and it's to ask if the council would be interested in asking staff to bring us back some guidance on how we could, or if we want to, limit the number of marijuana facilities in town to, I mean, there are four, maybe five now. And actually, since they don't even have to report, I think there could be more. And while I voted yes to 420, and as did the majority of Astorians, and I could really not care that less about it, but I do think we might want to look at how many of these do we want in our on 30 on Marine Drive and Commercial, and is it going to have an impact? Is it having an impact on livability? And so. Anybody else interested in that besides me?
I'd like to ask our city attorney, is that a possibility or is that illegal or to limit?
Cities do have authority to regulate what's called time, place, and manner, location of those facilities. And regulating the absolute number, I guess, is sort of a gray area, but certainly could be done with some
Is any comments from the council in regard to this matter?
I wonder where we're at with the opportunity to take advantage of what other cities are trying to take advantage of, and that is collecting taxes.
So, Councilor Nimmowell, I as well as Susan Brooks attended a marijuana seminar at the League of Oregon Cities.
I didn't go to that one.
And one of the things that we learned was, you know, There were the jurisdictions who passed resolutions about this time last year wanting to be able to have a sales tax that would go to cities, and that question was asked at this forum. The response from the League of Oregon Cities was it's still to be determined whether or not that is constitutional or not, or whether or not that's legal or not. That's still, even for those cities who passed those resolutions, it's still unknown at this time. We did ask, there was also another question that was asked about how much revenue would local jurisdictions see from the state tax that would be collected on marijuana, recreational marijuana. And the response was given was after all the the state takes their cut, and there's also the processing fees from the agencies that will be regulating marijuana, we're told it would be a small amount that would be coming to local entities. But still, because the recreational marijuana rules are still haven't been drafted, the only thing that's in place right now is allowing the medical marijuana dispensaries to now serve as sales locations for recreational marijuana as a temporary measure until such time the state establishes their full rulemaking process. We really don't know. The rulemaking process is going to happen through 2016. They're anticipating that fall of 2016, the rules for recreational marijuana at the state level will be finalized at that point. There's still still more to come.
Do you anticipate that there would be a review process by public entities such as us, much in the same way that liquor licenses are approved? So the police department would have an opportunity to review the proposal and make sure that the applicant was a law-abiding citizen and that it was sited in a safe location, for example.
Yes, I think there will be. There was some discussion that there will be planning department reviews of all permits, that there's a land use compatibility statement, or a LUX is their terminology, that would be required. But there very well could be a process like a liquor license, that because OLCC, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, where there may be cannabis, there may be another C added to the OLCC. And that could be part of the review.
OLCCC?
Not the dispensaries, right. It would be for recreational.
Mm. Thank you, Mr. City Manager and Mr. City Attorney.
Okay, is anyone interested in putting this issue on the agenda for council discussion at a future meeting? Or
I am. Because meanwhile, there are actually kind of no rules, and the city doesn't review licenses or request to occupy a space based on is it a medical marijuana place or anything, right?
Right. We look at base zoning, but with the business license, but in terms of we don't have any zoning prohibitions. We treat them as a commercial entity.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the other question that I would have is, would this be a big burden on planning staff to give us a couple of options that we could look at as a city council and then decide whether we want to adopt some rules or zoning or whatever they would recommend?
That's definitely doable, that the planning staff could work with the city attorney to come up with some different options.
Councilors, what say ye?
I guess I'm just curious, what your observations are or what you've heard. I haven't observed a problem yet.
Right, me either. I'd like to avoid having a problem, and I just don't know. I really don't have a sense of the community other than the Astorians did vote. For like 55% or so for 420. I'm still not sure that Astorians really want to have a pot shop on, every other corner. And as I was talking to the city attorney about this earlier today, and I believe that over time the market will work some of these things out themselves. But in the meanwhile, do we want to do anything? And I would like to do something.
I would think that we should, and you're asking for direction from staff on what we could do. I would like to trust the staff to bring those to us if they think they're a problem. If we're not having a problem, why spend a lot of time on it?
Because we're here to ask staff sometimes that they have other things to do. Anyway. I guess not. Let's go on.
Thank you for the suggestion. We're going to recess now into executive session, and we will reconvene to a regular session following this meeting. We are returning from recess at 9:05 into general session, and we want to report that the city manager has been evaluated. It is a good evaluation. We recommend a salary adjustment of 2.5% as provided to city employees and department heads this fiscal year, retroactive to 1 year anniversary date of hiring. Do we need a vote on that, or okay? Could we have a motion to approve the evaluation and
so moved
that recommendation?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Great. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, that was good.